Whenever the court's ready.
All right. And I assume you would like to reserve a certain portion of your time for rebuttal?
How about 4 minutes?
4 minutes? That's fine. You have it. You may proceed when you're ready.
Your Honor, my name is Pete Trisano. This is Megan Casey, and we represent Ms. Reed in connection with this appeal. What we're asking the court to do, or this court to do, is to reverse the trial court's denial of our motion to compel, order Mr. Reed to pay $111,000, order him to pay interest, and order him to pay attorney's fees. And the basis for our
appeal... Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you early on, but I want to make sure that we get this right. In reference to the show cause that you appealed, you are, at this time, you agree that Jenkins controls and are you not...
Oh, yes. Yes, you're right. Yes, we cannot appeal the show cause. We agree with
that. Right. I noticed in your reply brief that you certainly did, but I wanted to make sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
No worries. The first place we start is with the parties' agreement. And as we cite in our briefs, and I will go over those cases with you, but as we cite in the brief, the first start for any case is the parties' agreement. And if you read the agreement, it says, among other things, that the parties determined to settle all questions about support, maintenance, and property rights between each other. And to settle and adjust all controversies that and they have executed that this agreement with the intent and that understanding.
Counsel, I also hate to interrupt you so early in your
sure.
your argument, but quick question for you. In terms of the time frame of this, the decree is entered on September 28th, at the same date that the motion to compel, which is what you're here
correct.
Arguing now, is filed. Is that your understanding? The following day, there is an argument in reference to the motion to compel and also the show cause. And
correct.
If I understand the decree kept on the docket for purposes of argument only the show cause.
Well, actually, both, Your Honor. It kept on both. And first, the actual agreement was filed in February of 2016.
No, I'm just talking about the court's order. Doesn't the court's order just keep on the docket the show cause?
With respect to the final decree?
Yes.
Well, at the trial, we filed the motion to compel, and that was brought before the court, and the court allowed us to go forward with that.
Yes, sir, but I guess what I'm asking is you would agree that a court speaks through its orders. My question to you is just simply for purposes of keeping it on the docket after the final decree, didn't the decree only note that the show cause was going to continue on the docket?
I believe, yes, I think that's what it said, but then when it's convoluted because it was all at the same time and we weren't sure whether the decree was entered and we weren't there when the decree was entered.
That brings me to my second question. If in fact that is the date, it's entered on the 28th and it indicates that only the show cause is on the docket for purposes to be heard later and not the motion to compel, what if any effect does that have on the second order that deals with the denial of both the show cause and the motion to compel that happens after 21 days?
Well, it's not a final order, Judge, until the 21 days, and the court did take up the motion to compel, did rule on it. It was brought before the court. The court did consider it, did articulate her reasons for denying it, and so it
but
was...
But again, if a court speaks only through its orders, my question to you is, does that have any effect on our ability to actually have jurisdiction to hear the appeal?
No. In my opinion, no, it does not. It does not. So if you go with...
Excuse me, counsel, tell us why not.
Well, because, again, it was still within the breast of the court within the 21 days. It was still within the breast of the court. It was brought before the court. There was no indication from the court or counsel that the court didn't have authority, and everybody agreed that the court would hear that motion on that day.
Well, counsel, I don't think that counsel and or the circuit court judge, the trial judge, can confer jurisdiction where it doesn't exist. Let me ask you this. Let's go down a different road, which is very similar and connects to the road that Judge Malvo was talking about. If you have a final decree, and you have orders. One was entered in 2010, I think, the one you're talking about in your motion to compel, and the other one was the injunctive order, two orders which you're trying to compel, plus the PSA, the separation agreement, I believe you call it. and you're trying to compel compliance of those orders, let's leave the separation agreement out. Those orders, did they not merge into the final decree? They were not excluded from the final decree. They were orders during the pendency of the divorce, and why would they not have merged?
You're correct with respect to the June 2010 consent pendente lite order. Yes, you are. But with respect to the agreement and the motion to compel, as the motion to compel says, we are asking the court to enforce the agreement, which now became incorporated into the order, which was filed back in February. And the PSA, or the property settlement agreement, says that there is a continuing injunction against disbursement of the funds.
When did the PSA become part of an order?
With the final decree, with the entry into the decree, it was filed. The statute says you have to act in 2109C is the court cannot deviate if the agreement is on file. And it was on file as early as February of 2016, some 6 months prior to the hearing.
But you're trying to, counsel, explain to me, you're trying to enforce those two orders plus the one order. Plus the property settlement agreement. The property settlement agreement did not become part of a court order until the very day that you filed your motion to compel, and you do not reference the final decree as the order that you're trying to compel.
Well, there's two things, Judge. One, there was a show cause that you violated the court's order with respect to the injunction. That was the first thing. The motion to compel says you violated the terms of the agreement. The agreement that was filed with the court in February, the agreement that is now part of the final decree. So the motion to compel is not the show cause. It's you violated the agreement. Paragraph 23 of the motion to compel says, and it does recite, as Ms. Nero pointed out, some of the same facts and circumstances that gave rise to the show cause. But the paragraph 23 of the motion to compel says you violated the agreement. And there are obviously different different requests or prayers for relief. And so we were saying, Judge, compel him to comply with the agreement that you just entered. And that was,
But that's not exactly what your pleading states, does it? Your pleading, which takes us to where we need to go, your pleading for your motion to compel asks your trial court judge to compel performance of a PSA, separation agreement, and also the two orders. Am I mistaken? I could be mistaken.
With respect, Judge, if you look at it, and I want to get the page number.
I don't want to take up all your time.
The motion to compel says you violated the agreement. Judge, compel him to pay $111,000, award interest, award fees. So that was the prayer for relief. It wasn't find him in contempt. It was he violated the agreement. Order payment to my client, to Ms. Reed. That's what the motion to compel says. That's what the prayer for relief is. So it wasn't hold him in contempt or anything like that.
Right, I understand that. You still have that avenue available should you choose to use it. Go back and refile if, in fact, something should go amiss.
Well, I hear you, Judge, but I think we're going to get a funny guy. I love the name of that case. We're going to get a funny guy argument if that comes up.
I understand what you're
which
saying.
Is another reason why, with that case and with the articulation of the standard that okay. Do everything when you can in one day.
Okay, then if we circle back around to Judge Malva's question to you, then that we all agree because we're all seasoned lawyers, basically, that the trial court only speaks through their orders. And the trial court spoke on September the 28th. The final decree was entered. It saved the show cause. And the motion to compel order, and which he also called, I guess it's just called order, maybe, I'm not sure what it's titled, but it rules on the show cause and also the motion to compel.
Correct.
Is entered on 10/26/16. There's more than 21 days there. So how do you, if you didn't like my argument, then how do you get by Judge Malva's argument?
Well, the hearing was held, I believe, and I have to, let me get my dates here so I make sure that I'm.
The hearing was actually held on 9/29.
Correct. And the court considered and entered the order
The order was entered on October the 26th, I believe.
Correct. So the court considered, on the date of the hearing, considered the show cause and our motion to compel, and then there was obviously some orders back and forth, and the court entered it. So it was entered, and the court did consider that inside the 21 days, even though the order was entered much later.
Is that the way Rule 1-1 reads? Supreme Court Rule 1-1, I don't think that that's the way that...
Well, the order was reflecting the order reflecting the... And I'll have to... Let me pull the final decree, because I'm not sure...
To follow up on Judge Chapin's question, did the court hold in abeyance its September 28th, 2016 ruling in past 21 days, at any point in that 21 days, so that it could enter an order more than 21 days later?
The answer is obviously no, because the court didn't put that in the order. But then the question becomes, does the court have continuing jurisdiction under 2107, I think it's K, or all that, to enforce and thereafter enforce its orders and decrees and stipulation agreements that are incorporated? The answer
is generally done through show causes.
Yes, but it also can be in a motion to compel as well. And so, yes, that was... Yes, the divorce decree was entered. We had a hearing on the show cause after, and a hearing on the motion to compel thereafter. So again, I go back to the... I'm sorry if I've answered everybody's question. If you go back to the agreement speaks and says that essentially from February of 2008 forward, each party is going to be responsible for their separate debts. That actually expanded the prior consent decree that was entered by the parties in June of 2010 that says each party is going to be responsible for their separate debts on or after June 1st, 2010. The agreement also delineates a procedure or talks about the proceeds from the sale of a business. It says the...
I should let you know you've gone into your rebuttal time.
Okay, I'll wait then, Judge.
Okay, you may proceed or
I'll wait. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Muroff?
May it please the court, Kenny Muroff and Mr. Reed. Bootstrapping my opening comments to this jurisdictional issue, I think there's two ways to go about it. One is, as Judge Malvo and Judge Chafin, their questions direct. A court speaks through its order, and the issue of the motion to compel was not preserved in the final decree, A, and B, the other order was outside of 21 days. I kind of went about it a little bit differently in my brief. I went about it in terms of an analysis of Judge Kelsey's decision in the Funny Guy case. And I think that Mrs. Reed kind of, you know, lawyering is very, very hard in family law cases, and it's an imperfect art form. But I think, pardon the expression, but it may have been overthunk a little bit. I think what hindsight is 20/20. Mr. Chisano is an excellent family law practitioner. I think if you can get by this court's questions on whether or not there was even jurisdiction to hear the motion to compel, if you get by that, the Funny Guy case poses a problem because res judicata...
Not to interrupt you, let me stop you. Just very generally in reference to the Funny Guy and its applicability here. We're not really truly talking about successive litigations when you're talking about the motion to compel and the motion for show cause all heard within the same hearing. So why would Funny Guy actually be applicable in terms of supporting your res judicata argument?
Because
having a little bit of a hard time getting there on that one.
Res judicata deals with preclusion, and preclusion has two heads to it. One is claims and one is issues. The issue in the show cause was whether he should be held in contempt for authorizing the payment of the attorney's fees out of the interpleader funds. The judge said no contempt. That issue automatically, respectfully, is dispositive of the issue in the motion to compel.
But they're decided at the same time. The whole premise behind res judicata is to prevent successive litigations and matters that have been previously, claims that have been previously determined not to come up again. In fact, in the Funny Guy, essentially, the whole premise of that is, look, you had the opportunity to bring up these claims before. Don't bring up ancillary claims that you had the opportunity to bring up at that time. And in this particular case, they're brought up at the same time. So how is it you think Funny Guy is supportive of your position of res judicata?
Because I think that in Funny Guy, there were two distinct causes of action, albeit not heard on the same day.
Two different theories, two different times.
Correct, Your Honor. But these are two distinct causes of action, and the pleadings are precisely the same. The exhibits are precisely the same. And I respectfully argue that when the trial court said Mr. Reed was not in contempt because of what he did in paying the attorney's fees, that is dispositive of the motion to compel pleading. Even though it's on the same day, it's still two distinct pleadings. I understand the court's position that there was a sequence in Funny Guy.
Well, it's a question. It's not necessarily a
question. I understand, Your Honor. So I think there's multiple layers of jurisdictional problems in this matter.
Well, counsel, now, may I ask you, so by your argument, in reference to, and I understand Funny Guy, or I think I do, but by your argument, you're stating that if you're found not guilty of the show cause, that in this particular case, that that means that therefore you can't impose the motion to compel. But that's not always true, is it? I mean, you can have failed to pay, for instance, let's say a spousal support, but if you have legitimate reasons, you might not be found in contempt, even though you would be found that you owe the money. So you're making a distinction, I guess, between, help me, please.
I am, Your Honor. The appellant kind of handed this argument out on a silver platter because the pleadings are precisely the same. Literally, to the paragraph, the exhibits are precisely the same. The motion to compel payment was filed the day before the hearing on September 29th. So I think that's a little bit of a... I don't dispute what your question, the premise of Your Honor's question, but I think there's a little bit of a different wrinkle in this particular case because of the parallel nature of the two pleadings. Perhaps the strongest argument is maybe the language in the final decree and the fact that the order is more than 21 days out. I'm going to kind of segue into maybe some of the substantive arguments under the possibility that the court will decline to find that there's no jurisdiction.
Counsel, I have one other question for you. During the pendency of a divorce, we all know that there are many orders or decrees that may be entered, many of which are called pendente lite, or they may be called various things, but they're orders that are entered during the pendency of the divorce till the final decree. Once a final decree is entered, unless the court reserves that opportunity in that final decree, how do you back up and try to enforce something that came before the final decree, which is the whole point and purpose is the reason it's entitled final decree?
One of the great things about being a lawyer is you can have an alternative universe. If that argument applies to Mr. Reed, then I would agree with the court that you don't look at the June 2010 order and you don't look at the June 2015 order. However, in fairness, if you look at the business section of the agreement, it's such funds are subject to an injunction order entered by the Virginia Beach Circuit Court. It doesn't say which order. And in my brief, I referred to paragraphs 11 and 13 in the June 2010 order. Appellant only referred to paragraph 9. And paragraphs 11 and 13 of that order kept equitable distribution in play. And the June 2015 order kept ED in play. And I think one could argue that Judge Shockley kind of implicitly looked at how am I going to define what the proceeds are to be divided? What's fair, what's reasonable under the language of the agreement? And if you look at 107.3E, factor 2, is the monetary and non-monetary contributions of each party to the acquisition, care, and maintenance of marital property. And factor four, I think, is how and when marital property was acquired. And we had all this testimony that was undisputed from the lawyers that were working on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Reed, plus Mr. Reed's own testimony about how his business was absolutely in a catastrophic state, that really he was selling debt. And the efforts of these attorneys and Mr. Reed actually preserved the marital property for Mrs. Reed and Mr. Reed. And I think that's a fair interpretation of the language in the agreement when you get down to the nitty-gritty in this particular case.
Well, counsel, and what would you say in reference to then the fees for the criminal lawyer for Mr. Reed?
Well, I think that is part. Here's what Mr. Woodward's role was in this case. There was a potential criminal investigation early on. Originally, the target was Mr. Benton and Mr. Reed.
Arguably, the target was primarily Mr. Benton, though.
Correct. Through the efforts of Mr. Woodward and his relationships with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and this is on the record, he kind of made this go away. Now, why is that an important contribution? It's an important contribution because AEG, who bought this, and they're one of the largest entertainment groups in the country, promoting Michael Jackson's concerts and stuff like that, they would have not touched this with a 10-foot pole if there had been a federal criminal investigation that they knew about or a federal charge pending that they knew about. They wouldn't have touched this with a 10-foot pole. And that's the contribution of Mr. Woodward. It's kind of subtle. Plus, Mr. Woodward was at the settlement conference in July of 2015 when the deal was struck with Mr. Benton on how much money was going to be left for each party to split. And he played a role in that settlement conference, as he testified to on the record. So, Your Honor, I do think Mr. Woodward made a valuable contribution in this particular case based on the arguments I've just articulated. I think Judge Shockley, I think she did what ought to be done in this case. You know, hindsight's 20/20. Maybe the record could be a little bit more precise. I understand that. But, you know, trial practiced by courts and judges and by attorneys is an imperfect exercise. And the question is, at the end of the day, based on the record and the agreement, was there an appropriate decision made? If you get by this jurisdictional argument, was there an appropriate and fair decision made? And I think it's clearly that there was a fair decision made. I guess when you don't have anything else to say, you pause.
Any further questions for Mr. Muroff?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Muroff.
I'm sorry, my eyesight, I can't see that clock too well.
That's all right. You have.
Let me answer some of the jurisdictional questions. And I was right on my 2107.3 case says the court shall have continuing authority and jurisdiction to make any additional orders necessary to effectuate and enforce any order entered pursuant to this section, including the authority to, and it goes on. Now, let me talk about what Mr. Muro said. Here's the whole rub. Judge Shockley went through an equitable distribution analysis, but she ignored the agreement. The agreement says there is no more equitable distribution. We agree that we're settling all our rights. There was one, and I tried my best to get the court to focus on the one issue that was dispositive and that was left to remain. Were there attorney's liens? Now, Mr. Reed paid people under an attorney lien premise when one of them is not even an attorney. One of them is an accountant. And attorney's liens are, and I go to the second part of my argument, attorney's liens are statutory creations. And if you generate arrests or you generate a cause of, if you generate a pot of money, you have a lien.
I just want to make sure I totally understand that your argument is that in order for these attorneys to be paid, they would have actually had to place a lien, a specific actual lien on the property.
The attorney's liens provision is unlike an Article 9 provision, and it's unlike a judgment lien. The easiest example I can give you is, let's say, a personal injury case. If I have a personal injury case, and I pursue that personal injury case, and We switch lawyers. The plaintiff switches lawyers. And there's a recovery. I would have a lien on that recovery for the services I rendered because there is a recovery. If there is no recovery, I have no lien. The statute talks about a cause of action.
But generally, in that particular case, what the attorney does, the first attorney, he writes a letter to the second attorney, the defense attorney, and usually to the insurance company.
Correct. You have a lien, and then there's the perfection of the lien. The perfection of the lien requires you to notify opposite parties. And I would invite the court to
look. But arguably, wasn't that done here?
No, it wasn't. And that's the whole. I got the wrong book.
Okay.
If you look at the letters, there are letters from two different attorneys on both sides. Let me get my notes here, so I can point in the record. There was two sides of the litigation. One was a Mr. Snow of Crenshaw Ware. He sends a letter. He sends a letter to Mr. Reed. Mr. Crenshaw Ware represents Mr. Benton. So he sends a letter to Mr. Benton. He sends a letter to Mr. Benton, and he sends a letter to the other side of the case, Mr. Reed and his attorneys. Contrast that. There's no letter, no notice from Shuttleworth. There's no letter notice from Mr. Deloitte, and there's no letter from Ms. Michelson. So there's no notice to the opposite side. They fail. Mr. Albert's letter on behalf of LeClaire Ryan, that was only sent to Mr. Reed. That's not the opposite side, and that's what the statute says. And again, lawyers are just like creditors like everybody else. You stand in line, and if you recover, you get a lien. It's a charging lien, and you have that charging lien, and you can enforce it when you perfect it. And you perfect it by sending that letter. It wasn't perfected, no lien. And that was the issue I was trying desperately to get the court to focus on, is whether or not there was a lien. And again, the agreement talks about the parties agreed that there was an injunction against those funds. That's in the agreement. That's part of the court order. And then in the second paragraph, they said they may be subject to liens, whereas Mr. Reed, in his brief and his submissions to the court, they decided that there was a lien, and I'm paying it.
Mr. Chisano, I've allowed you to go over your time.
Sorry.
And would you like to wrap up for us briefly?
Well, Judge, again, I asked the court to look at the agreement. If the agreement says Mr. Reed's responsible for his separate debts after the date of separation and the prior order in June 10th, he's responsible for his separate debts. There is no equitable distribution after December 3rd, 2016. How can the court go do an equitable distribution analysis, and how can the court should not ignore the plain language which says he's responsible for those debts? That was part of the agreement, and if we were going to do an equitable distribution analysis on debts and what people did to preserve the marital assets, as we said in our objections, we should be given the opportunity to do that again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chisano. We will greet counsel, and then I see Mr. Sachs in the back of the courtroom. Before we move to